Judges of the United States Court of Appeals in and for the Seventh Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States in this honorable court.
Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is United States versus Gant. And Mr. Goodridge, you'll be making the first argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, well, welcome. Good morning.
I'll be arguing for appellants Dion Gant and Wilfredo Barrios this morning. This case initiated in the Southern District of Indiana, Evansville Division, in January of 2002 with the United States of America filing an indictment. Thereafter, a superseding indictment was filed in February of 2002, naming 14 co-defendants, of which both Mr. Gant, Mr. Barrios, Mr. Carrico, and Mr. Vigil were counted. The case then proceeded to a jury trial for defendants Barrios, Carrico, and Vigil on the third day of March 2003 and concluded on the 11th day. With regard to Mr. Gant, however, he did not go to jury trial. He entered into a plea agreement, was later determined by the district court to have breached that plea agreement, and went to sentencing in April of 2003. Mr. Barrios went to sentencing in August of 2003, and the appeal process ensued. All relevant deadlines have been met. With regard to Mr. Barrios and Mr. Gant, in Mr. Barrios' argument in the reply brief and in the supplemental brief, it is based upon the premise that there was not a return on the return from the jury by proof beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Barrios was responsible for at least 15 kilograms of methamphetamine. In the United States of America Sir reply brief, however, Mr. Blackington called to my attention that, in fact, there was a jury return of more than 15 kilograms of methamphetamine, and he attached that as an exhibit. That was jury instruction number 25. I had previously attached jury instruction number 28. Mr. Blackington is correct, and I have to concede that. However, that does not negate Mr. Barrios' argument under Booker Fanfan with regard to count one. It would impact his argument with regard to count two. But with regard to count one, Mr. Barrios was still sentenced not illegal but constitutionally volatile sentencing procedures, that being the federal sentencing guidelines. He was ultimately sentenced at base offense level 42, criminal history category 3. However, the judge imposed a sentence of 480 months instead of the minimum term of 360 months, and that impacts an argument for prejudice. Upon those facts and that correction of the record, I will leave that issue for Mr. Barrios with the court. I would like to address Mr. Gant. Mr. Gant, the Booker-Fanfan issue, the Blakely-Booker-Davis issues, are all incredibly relevant. Mr. Gant had pled to the charge. In the course of pleading, I examined the record for Mr. Gant, and in the course of the plea colloquy and the hearing on the breach of the plea agreement, he admitted to approximately 39.5 pounds, which is above the 15 kilograms, which, prior to the Booker-Fanfan issue, was relevant. In that he made an admission of weight. The other relevant consideration prior to Booker Fanfan, just under Booker and under Davis, and Blakely, of course, was his categorization as a career offender. The criteria for career offenders are primarily based upon prior criminal history convictions, which fall under the previous Apprendi doctrine. So his argument in the reply brief was premised upon the fact that he received a two-level adjustment upward for obstruction of justice. In the original brief, I argued that that was not permissible under the guidelines because of the footnote to the career offender statute, which says that the only Chapter 2 adjustment that will apply to a career offender is acceptance of responsibility, and of course obstruction of justice could then not apply. where we are left on his argument after Booker Fanfan, the United States Supreme Court decision, however, is all of that pretty much is gone because the guidelines are only advisory. They are not mandatory. However, he was sentenced under a mandatory sentencing scheme, and he was sentenced at a base offense level 37 on unusual facts, very unusual facts, as this court has recognized in other cases. Not only was he given obstruction of justice, but the very unusual occurrence occurred where the judge also found, in spite of obstructing justice, he was also entitled to acceptance of responsibility. That is an indication that the judge was reluctant to impose against Mr. Gant a sentence at base offense level 38, criminal history category 6.
Would you like us to send this back to have the district judge say what he would have or would not have done?
On Gant, I think it is required. An examination of his sentencing transcript, if I may call it to the court's attention, on pages 41... the court specifically says the court is sentencing the defendant at the low end of the sentencing guideline range because of the defendant's role in this offense and the fact that 30 years is a significant sentence. And the judge did everything possible that he could do in the contrary findings of obstruction of justice and acceptance of responsibility to get him into a lower category, that being criminal history or base offense level 37 as compared to a 40.
Does the sentence have to be vacated?
The sentence doesn't have to be vacated because he did not move to withdraw his plea agreement. The sentence would have to be vacated for correction.
Why?
But the judgment...
Why does it have to be vacated? Why can't it be remanded and have the district judge decide? The judge says I would have imposed the same sentence under a advisory scheme.
I guess it's my inherent belief. I do not believe the judge would impose that.
Well, yeah, then the judge could decide, I'll vacate the sentence. Why should we vacate the sentence?
It would also be appropriate to remand for further reasoning by the court to see what the judge would have done. That would be an appropriate remedy, and I've had that done in other cases.
You have?
United States versus John Johnson, now pending in front of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. They remanded it back to... the judge in Indianapolis for additional findings of fact to be resubmitted to the Seventh Circuit. However, shortly after that case was handed down, that order was handed down. I was preparing for the district court. The court then recalled the case once again to the Seventh Circuit, and it remains before the panel.
So it was going to go that way, but it's back before us again.
Exactly. So I have ran into that before. With regard to the other issues in Mr. Barrios' case, the wiretap issues, there's two of them. Number one is probable cause. The second one, may I?
Sure.
Okay. The first one's probable cause. The second one is the sufficiency of the investigative procedures. I call the court's attention to page 5 of the judge's opinion, denying the same. And basically, because the government has gotten into the practice of using form applications for wiretaps, you run into minimum threshold findings with regard to probable cause with contrary explanations of their investigative procedures. And what this application really does is it works against each other on the basis of the two. Where the judge wants to find probable cause, the fact that they need the wiretap under Title III, they're saying, we can't find anything out. So I think I'm entitled to win and have that denial of that motion corrected on that basis. And then with regard to the wiretap summary, I've argued this before in front of the Seventh Circuit. I'm asking the court to reconsider its decision in Breland based upon the prior rule of the Seventh Circuit in Keck and Papilla.
Okay. Thank you,
Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Goodridge. Ms. Williams?
Good morning. My name is Barbara Williams. I appear this morning on behalf of Chad Carrico, who was convicted and sentenced in the under the same case that Mr. Goodridge previously described for the court. Your Honors, I would at this time ask the court to take note of the fact that I have joined in the argument that Mr. Goodridge made with respect to the issues with respect to the conspiracy. This morning, I'm primarily here to argue on behalf of Mr. Carrico that under the new law of Booker fanfan that Mr. Carrico is entitled to new sentencing for the reasons stated in that law. The issues raised, I believe, on behalf of Mr. Carrico revolve around initially the government's position that perhaps Mr. Carrico waived his right to be sentenced, waived his right to make this request. I believe that the record is clear, the sentencing record is clear, that there was a significant and substantial discussion at the sentencing hearing with respect to the four objections made to the upward adjustments on Mr. Carrico's sentencing. We believe that the court would have not imposed a sentence according to the level 40, would have imposed sentence according to level 32, that there would be a significant change in the sentence that Mr. Carrico could have received. I believe also, Your Honors, that the language from Booker fanfan is applicable to Mr. Carrico, in which the Supreme Court held that the determination that the defendant obstructed justice in Carrico's case, like the determination in Apprendi, where the court found that the defendant had acted with racial malice, increased the sentence that the defendant could have received otherwise. Since that fact was found by a judge, not by the jury, using a preponderance of the evidence, the defendant's sentencing rights were violated. We believe that that rationale and that rule of law applies in Mr. Carrico's case. I believe that the court could remand for new sentencing in response to a question that was asked with earlier. Would I like the case to be sent back to ask Judge Young what he would have done? I certainly would like the opportunity to argue to present arguments on behalf of Mr. Carrico to Judge Young as to what we believe the proper sentence should be. Our briefs and our legal argument today does request that the matter be remanded for a new sentencing hearing. We believe that the law, the recent law under Booker fanfan applies. To wrap up and to reiterate, I do not believe that in any way Mr. Carrico waived any right at the time of sentencing. In addition, we believe that under Rule 52B, the new rule of law and plain error, that there was no waiver at all because it could not have been anticipated by Mr. Carrico at the time of sentencing that this new rule of law would have applied. So I believe that the argument that the government has made in its briefs with respect to waiver, it does not apply, and that Mr. Carrico is entitled to be sentenced either, according to our request in the briefs, by a remand for a new sentencing, or if the court would so choose, a specific request to Judge Young as to what he would have done in light of this new law. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Williams. Mr. Groves.
Met Police Court. My name is Chad Groves. I represent Appellant Jose Vigil. First of all, I'd like to address the Booker and Booker fanfan issue and allow my issues regarding the competency evaluation and the other psychiatric issues to stand. I believe I've appropriately briefed those issues and they're included in the record. I'm not asking this court to speculate as to what the district court or Judge Young would have done. I think that opens a floodgate that the court is not interested in opening. I think it's important that we look at what Judge Young did, not what he would have done. All sentences under the guidelines are not in violation of the Sixth Amendment. The sentence in this particular case, specifically with regard to Mr. Vigil, and also the co-appellants, were in violation of the sentencing guidelines. Mr. Vigil was sentenced under offense level 38 based upon findings made by the judge that were not found by the jury. Mr. Vigil should have been sentenced under level 32 based upon what the jury found in the judge's ruling that he enhanced based upon weight, is in violation of Jose Vigil's Sixth Amendment's right. This was a plain error that affected a substantial right of Mr. Vigil.
Are you asking us to determine whether it was reasonable or not?
Your Honor, I think it goes beyond that. I think it's patently unreasonable because at the time the federal sentencing guidelines were mandatory and the sentencing was in violation of those mandatory guidelines. So in any situation where the sentence takes from the jury something that should have been found by the jury, it is patently unreasonable.
So what you would have us vacate the sentence and send it back for resentencing? How would Judge Young then understand what his limits are with regard to the sentence?
It's a unique situation. The fact that the error occurred with regard to the sentencing under the guidelines when they were mandatory, now that they are no longer mandatory, Judge Young would be allowed to sentence under the statute and use the guidelines as advisory. I believe if the guidelines were advisory on this issue, we wouldn't be before the court today. In fact, this is a cornerstone right of the United States judicial system, the Sixth Amendment right to a jury, that although the federal sentencing guidelines are no longer mandatory, at the time Jose Vigil was sentenced, they were mandatory. We have to temper our view to that time. Thank you, Your Honor. I would reserve the remaining of my time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Groves. Mr. Blackington.
You. May it please the court, I wanted to address first briefly some of the issues that I frankly thought were easier to decide. The wiretap issues with regard to necessity, we stand by the Sabalos case and the other opinions that we have cited, and consistent with those opinions, we believe that the affidavit established the necessity and the adequate use or explanations for why other law enforcement techniques were not used. With regard to the probable cause inquiry, I think specifically the use of Brian Davis's cellular telephone when the currency was seized from Dion Gant at the Evansville airport, it showed Mr. Davis in contact with the airlines trying to arrange for a flight for Robert Gant to fly to Los Angeles. It had him in contact with Mr. Berrios at every relevant stage of the proceeding, from when he got to the airport, from when he fled the security checkpoint at the airport, to when he picked up the taxi, ultimately to when the police stopped him, showed that Brian Davis was using that cellular telephone to communicate these events to Wilfredo Barrios and establish probable cause with the use of the telephone. The use of transcripts and names in the margins, I'd ask the court to continue to follow the Breland opinion. Without that type of aid, these transcripts would be virtually useless, and it would be very difficult for a jury to try to follow the transcripts and follow the conversations. The language, the CCE instruction in the alleged requirement that the appellants have offered, that we establish the identity of the five supervisees of Wilfredo Barrios, that argument's been rejected by this court in Hardin, and we'd ask the court to follow that opinion. Next, the issues regarding Jose Vigil's mental condition. First, there was a request for a competency hearing, but the motion requesting the competency hearing contained nothing that would have led the district court to believe that there was even a question that this defendant was competent to stand trial. the attached opinion may have laid the groundwork.
Couldn't counsel on his own have requested a competency hearing?
Well, I think that...
I mean, where he would say, I don't believe my client is competent.
Yes, Your Honor, but there was nothing in this motion where defense counsel said he was having difficulty communicating with his client. And I think that's what makes this different. You know, I've seen this several times as a federal prosecutor, many times in state court, and this is the only time I've ever seen a competency hearing requested without an affidavit from the defense counsel. So this isn't just a perfunctory thing. You got to have a basis for it, and there's nothing there. Regarding the notice of his mental condition, the attached report, psychiatric report, contains nothing to suggest a McNaughton-type classic insanity defense. There's a little bit of language in there that maybe he couldn't formulate the necessary mental state to participate in the conspiracy, but it was kind of mysterious because it apparently referred to an elaborate conspiracy that he was evaluated for in a California state proceeding instead of our conspiracy, which was a very simple, hey, take the dope to Tennessee and drop it off to a guy and take the money back. There was nothing, and that type of conclusion, had an expert given the opinion, in my opinion, this defendant can't form the mental state required to join the conspiracy, would have violated the ultimate issue rule. And Bookbinder stands a very similar case to this one that this court's handed down, and the court should reject that as well. Now we come to the difficult issue, and I think those are the Booker issues, and what this court should do with these cases and the other cases before it. Looking at each defendant individually, with Wilfredo Barrios, the jury returned a finding on the CCE violation, which was count two. He was sentenced to a mandatory life imprisonment under the CCE statute. So there's no reason to return his sentence in the conspiracy charge. It was count one for any reason. Frankly, there are some cases in this circuit that have held that the conspiracy merges into the CCE violation. The district court sentenced him anyway separately. But regardless of what happens with the other defendants, he's got a mandatory life sentence under the CCE statute. With regard to all of the defendants, except perhaps Mr. Carrico, there's also an appellate waiver issue. The deadline for the appellants to file the brief was several days after the Supreme Court's decision in Blakely and this court's decision in Booker. So these, at the time that the appellants had to file the brief, these were things that should have been raised in their opening briefs, and they weren't raised. So we feel they've waived their right to litigate the issue. The only person who raised an issue at all relating to Booker was Chad Carrico. He challenged in his opening brief the application of the obstruction of justice enhancement without a jury finding. And so perhaps he hasn't committed appellate waiver, but I think the others have by failing to include them in their original briefs.
Liking, let me take you back to this mandatory life sentence. It's your view that the district judge had no discretion other than to impose that life sentence?
On the CCE count, Your Honor, I think there was discretion. The guideline ranges were 30 to life, and of course, after Booker, the court could even depart below that. But on the CCE statute, it's a mandatory life sentence. So, there's that, and that's by statute. That's not by operation of the sentencing guidelines. Let me try to recall where I was here. With regard to the all of the appellants, I think as the Booker issues have been recast by the Supreme Court's opinion in Booker, it isn't appropriate to argue that the conduct of the appellants at their sentencing hearing constituted the right to waive the Booker issue as it's been recast by the Supreme Court into whether the district court erroneously concluded it was bound by the guidelines. The appellants couldn't have waived that issue at sentencing. They weren't aware of the possibility that the guidelines would be recast into an advisory role. So I think that the waiver of the sentencing
I didn't think anybody thought of viewing the guidelines as advisory until they read Justice Breyer's.
It's a strange...
Did you think that that was going to be a remedy?
It's a strange world we've been operating in the past year or so, Your Honor.
How could anybody anticipate that?
No, and so
I... Where in Blakely are any of these... Apprendi or any of these issues, prior decisions, was that flagged?
If it's there, Your Honor, I sure haven't seen it. So I don't think that their conduct at the sentencing hearing was a waiver of their rights, but I think it is forfeiture. That the fact is they didn't raise the issue. So where we are now and where we are in the Supreme Court's opinion in Booker is the plain error doctrine applies. And so looking at the third and fourth prong, certainly the district court did err by failing to recognize at the sentencing hearing that the guidelines were advisory, and apparently they have been all along. But the third and fourth prong of the plain error doctrine apply. The third prong's prejudice. None of these appellants can show that the district court would have sentenced them any differently had it considered the guideline range to be advisory instead of mandatory.
How do we know that unless the district court takes a bite at it?
Well, we really don't know that, and that's the problem that the appellants have in this case. The burden of proof's on them to show the district court would have done something differently. In some cases, district courts have looked at defendants and say, geez, I hear the guidelines, I hate them, they apply unfairly in this case, and we're stuck with them. There isn't any hint in the record that they would have been sentenced any differently. And the plain...
Well, huge sentences in this case. 360 months.
Your Honor, I please don't ask me to cite the case, because, but I know that the Supreme Court case has applied the plain error doctrine in capital cases.
I don't know who benefits from this, but you've got three judges on this court who sentenced prior to the sentencing guidelines.
I don't know. I don't know, but it's
I sentenced prior to and with the guidelines. It was a better system prior to.
I worked.
Plus, there were no appeals. I don't know what the Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit did.
Had a lot of slack time then.
I sentenced prosecuted people in a state court system where the guidelines were advisory as well, and it's a different world. But I think if the plain error doctrine is going to have any force, and the Supreme Court says it should have force, that it has to be applied in this case, and it's the defendant's
burden. Isn't there always a chance, though, that the district judge would give a lesser sentence?
Sure.
And if that's the case, haven't all the prongs of the plain error test been met?
No, because the defense, the appellant, has to show he would have gotten a lesser sentence.
Go ahead. Well, we wouldn't, referencing an early comment, Mr. Blackman, we wouldn't want to turn these cases on whether a district judge in sentencing under the structure when it was mandatory, you know, pre-Booker, happened to opine or editorialize, gee, I don't like the guidelines, and another judge didn't, and then suggest, I guess you're suggesting, maybe we should give some deference if the judge mused about I don't like the guidelines, but I have to impose them. So that isn't the kind of proof that you're asking the appellants to come up with, are you?
That's one type of proof, but
can the government's position be that we have some judges who are uncomfortable and so forth? They advance that thought. Another judge who may be uncomfortable but is not of a mind to express it because it's of no moment at the time of the sentencing under the old structure. So we should tip our hat to the one who makes the comment. I mean, that's kind of a scary distinction for me.
I think, though, what it shows is how really difficult the plain error standard is, and the Supreme Court said it applies in this case, and if it's to be given any force, the appellants have to come up with some evidence to suggest that they would have been sentenced differently. We do deal with the plain error all the time in these evidentiary hearings after a trial. Okay, if this piece of evidence got in, would the jury have acquitted? And the fact is we really don't know because we're not in the minds of the jury, but we apply it to show that a reasonable jury would have done differently.
We're looking at the sort of the touchy-feely judge who says, well, I don't know, on one hand I would have done this, on the other hand I would have done that, or the judge who is more judge-like and said, this is what you get, right?
That's one of the issues that can come up.
We can't make a rule like that, though, can we?
Well, I think the rule's been made for us by the Supreme Court doctrine, and it is that the plain error doctrine applies, and it's those are the rules we operate under. And I think the other thing, we look at the fourth prong of the plain error doctrine, and it gives us some comfort. And does this seriously jeopardize the integrity of the judicial proceedings?
Well, that's a really bright line, isn't it?
Yeah, the guidelines have been used for 20 years to sentence people. Tens of thousands of people have been sentenced under the exact same procedure.
Now, how many years did we do without the guidelines or before that?
that's prior to my time, if I can say that. But we've sentenced people for 20 years or more, tens of thousands of people. It's a procedure that this court and the Supreme Court, up until, as the court has noticed, unpredictable happened. But it's been a procedure, the constitutionality of which has been upheld numerous times by this court, the Supreme Court, and as being a fair procedure for sentencing people. And I don't think that's changed. And even now the Supreme Court has said that this is where we ought to start. We ought to start with calculating the guidelines and then determining if the guideline sentence is reasonable. This is such a fair proceeding, the Supreme Court has said, keep using it as a basis for your sentencing, but you can still depart from it if you feel the sentence is reasonable. So I think under the plain error doctrine...
How does that work in Indiana with the sentencing guidelines they have as advisory?
I was in Pennsylvania, Your Honor,
then
before coming.
Describe Pennsylvania, then.
I thought it was really a pretty good system, and it was...
You had sentence appeals then, I assume.
You had sentencing appeals, and usually what would happen if a judge departed from the guideline range, the appellate standard was that the trial court had to give a reasonability standard why they either went above or below. And
similar to what the Supreme Court may be indicating in the Booker case.
I think so, Your Honor, and I thought it worked reasonably well. But it had the element of predictability, and in some level of judicial flexibility. But you know, I think it's really a pretty good system. It worked well there, but that. Please don't consider that as compromising my plain error argument in this case.
I know there's a playbook everybody's playing by. We're going to hear it five or six times today.
And you'll hear it from me twice next week if you're on the panels.
It's going to be Groundhog Week.
We'll look forward to
it. And I'll duck. No, thank you. Are there any other questions that anyone on the panel has? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Blackington. All right. Mr. Goodrich, do you want to?
Counsel for co-appellants have requested me address the waiver issue. Waiver just simply doesn't apply on this case. The fact of the matter is no one anticipated Blakely, and then no one anticipated the wise and well-reasoned decision in Booker. And for the co-defendants, their arguments didn't become plainly apparent until this Court of Appeals decision in Davis. And yes,
I'm sorry. I was going to ask you about, if you get to the mandatory life sentence, where the judge had no discretion then to vote.
The basis of the argument could be in the alternative, but Brad addressed that in his footnote. They addressed that in their footnote. It's a statutory finding. It was submitted to the jury. It's a minimum mandatory, and I think I don't think that I can get it in under Booker Fanfan. Believe me, I've been trying. I really have. Under every theory, I can't.
I don't think so either. But that's
I tried. So. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Goodrich. Ms. Williams?
Thank you for this opportunity for rebuttal. Your Honor, I think what Mr. Goodrich was trying to say with respect to the waiver is that prior to the time we filed the brief, we filed a motion asking for permission from the circuit to brief and raise the new issue, which was granted without objection from the government. And for that reason, we don't believe that we waived at the appellate level, irrespective of the sentencing level, the issue that are before the court. Your Honor, with respect to Mr. Carrico, I strongly believe that the plain error doctrine applies in Mr. Carrico's case, and that I think that the Johnson case, the language in Booker Fanfan, the Blakely case, it's all very relevant to Mr. Carrico. When I think it is just, to me, it's just so clear that he was fundamentally prejudiced because of the sentence that was imposed that wouldn't have been imposed, in my view, if the court had not had to be bound by the mandatory guidelines. And I am asking on behalf of Mr. Carrico that the sentence, that he be remanded for new sentencing before Judge Young. And just by way of comment, I've been practicing law a long time, and I've participated in many sentencing prior to the time that the guidelines were in effect. And quite frankly, as a defense counsel, sometimes it's very difficult to know what to say on behalf of your client at a sentencing hearing when these you can make objections to the adjustments, but you know that it's so difficult because and in Mr. Carrico's case, on page 49 of the sentencing hearing, the judge concluded, this is the minimum I can give you. This is the least I can give you. And with respect to Mr. Carrico, he had 360 months, which is a huge sentence for a young man of his background. He has a couple of felony convictions that the judge acknowledges in his dialogue with him that he believes are clearly a result of Mr. Carrico's horrible addiction to drugs. He was involved in this conspiracy. It was a horrible thing that he did. But Judge Young's dialogue with him is replete with his Judge Young's understanding that Mr. Carrico's plight and level 4 criminal history is because of his drug addiction. He ordered him to get drug counseling. He's a young man who's 30 years old who had never had a conviction before. He was 21 when he became addicted to drugs. And that's the kind of case where, as defense counsel, I would welcome an opportunity to ask the court to take those things into account. And I think when Judge Young said, this is the minimum I can give you, that's not him making a comment that he doesn't like the record, but at least it's a comment that I think that the court can take as an indication that he would be willing to take those kinds of things into account and perhaps not give Mr. Carrico a 30-year sentence. Those are the reasons, Your Honors, that we request an opportunity, that I request an opportunity on behalf of Mr. Carrico to make an argument for him to get a sentence that's less than 30 years.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Williams. Thank you. Mr. Groves.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything that seriously affects my client's right to a Sixth Amendment trial by a jury of his peers seriously affects the integrity of this judicial system. The Sixth Amendment is the cornerstone of this judicial system. The right to a trial by jury was something our founding fathers believed in tremendously, and it has worked successfully up until now. The guidelines for Mr. Vigil's sentencing were not advisory. They were mandatory. Judge Young, in his sentencing, stated to Mr. Vigil that although some of the factors regarding his record, that the court nevertheless believed the low end of the range was appropriate. It's a substantial sentence, to say the least. Mr. Vigil received 324 months in prison. Under Booker, Mr. Vigil would have received 168 months in prison. That's a 156-month difference. This case, we talk about Booker fan, and now the guidelines are advisory, but we have to remember at the time of sentencing, our case is exactly on point with Booker that was decided by this court. And simply because the guidelines are not advisory now does not mean that Jose Vigil's Sixth Amendment rights weren't violated then when the guidelines were mandatory. What Judge Young will do now, I don't know. However, Jose Vigil's Sixth Amendment violation needs to be remedied, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Groves.
Our
thanks to all counsel for the arguments presented, and the case will be taken under advisement. The court will proceed to the